So the dream plan that I had is failed, but so much has succeeded in any case, and we've launched the whole field. But I do think that the clinic of the future, and this is where I'm saying that there'll be roughly 6,000 clinics, I think, by 2030. The reason I say that is that there's around that many hospice centers in America. So every town that's big enough to have a hospice center, that's for people that are at the end of life, that are dying.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a greater percentage of people that have mental health issues throughout their lifespan than people right. just at their end of their life. So I think there'll be 6,000 or more clinics. And what we really want to do, and this is, again, somewhat different than profit maximizing company, which is we want the therapist to be cross-trained with MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, 5-MeO-DMT, and we want them to customize the treatment for each patient.
Yeah, yeah.
Psychedelic medicine is the goal. And what we need to do, and what every other company needs to do, is to study one drug at a time.
Welcome back to the Trip Report Podcast, a production of Beckley Waves, a psychedelic venture studio. Today I'm speaking with Rick Doblin, founder and president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, also known as MAPS. December of last year was a milestone for Doblin and MAPS as the organization submitted a new drug application for MDMA-assisted therapy to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Then, in the first week of January, the MAPS Public Benefit Corporation announced its rebranding to Lykos Therapeutics and a $100 million Series A financing round. Needless to say, it has been a pivotal period in the organization's history and a watershed moment for the revival of psychedelic medicine, science, and policy. In February, the FDA accepted the application and granted a priority review, putting the decision timeline at August of this year. That's just around the corner, and so much is still up in the air. Of course, the big question, will the FDA grant approval? But also so many granular details that will have significant downstream effects on access and cost, including what language will be on the drug label? What will the risk evaluation and mitigation strategies entail? How will patients be able to access the drug? What will the FDA say about the role of therapy, among others? So I wanted to sit down with Rick and talk about it and get his perspective on the organization's evolution, path ahead, and importantly, the many uncertainties that hang in the balance. In this conversation, we discuss his stressing the importance of therapy in conjunction with MDMA and his loathing of the acronym MDMA-AT, the many regulatory and bureaucratic details that go into the FDA's decision and subsequent commercial rollout, including drug labeling, therapist credentialing, and risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, the negotiations he's led with the FDA over the last 20 years, Lykos' goal of getting MDMA-assisted therapy approved, and MAPS' goal of getting MDMA federally legalized, the role of therapists' firsthand experience with MDMA, and the regulatory battle ensuring access for this group, and his future humanitarian and scientific plans. And now, without further ado, I bring you my conversation with Rick Doblin. The way that we got connected was Sherelle Noble, your former colleague, my current colleague, shared one of the essays that I wrote in which I employed the acronym MDMA-AT.
Oh, I hate
which
that.
You took gumption with.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be a good place
to start. Yeah.
I mean, the acronym is MDMA-assisted therapy, right? And I truncated it to AT, which, again, you took umbrage with. And I'm glad you did because it sort of set up this connection and conversation, but help me understand your rationale and thinking for that particular.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's not MDMA as the medicine, like S-ketamine approved for treatment-resistant depression, where the S-ketamine is considered to be the medicine and it was improved without therapy.
Right.
This is MDMA-assisted therapy.
Yeah.
And so when the pharma company changes what we talk about, MDMA-assisted therapy, to MDMA-AT, what they're doing is they're minimizing the therapy component of it. Nobody knows what AT stands for, but it's really just MDMA-AT.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can type it with a few less letters,
right,
but so what? So it just is the wrong emphasis. Mm-hmm. And so as the first psychedelic-assisted therapy product company going to market, hopefully through FDA approval sometime later this year, if all goes well, that it just sends the wrong message to say MDMA-AT. And the therapist didn't like it. There's a lot of concerns about different companies working with different substances that are trying to say you don't even need therapists, mm-hmm, you just mm-hmm. need psychological support, and trying to turn it into just a similar drug because it's easier to regulate. FDA doesn't regulate psychotherapy.
Yeah.
One of the concerns that's been expressed is, again, this training of the therapists, and do we want to create opportunities for them to have MDMA as part of their training, mm-hmm. always optional, never required. But there's no clear mechanism for FDA to do that. So anyway, MDMA-AT makes it seem like that's not necessary, mm-hmm. and it's just about the MDMA. So I felt that when I saw it, it totally was the wrong message.
Yeah.
And where we finally got Lykos to turn it around was in a new paper that just came out about 2 weeks ago with Bessel van der Kolk. And this was about MDMA and self-experience.
Self-experience, right, yeah.
You know, Bessel didn't work with us in phase two, just in phase three. Mm-hmm. And he started out by saying, you know, don't work with complex PTSD because it won't work so well. And we said, no, it seems to work. And we have to work with the hardest cases just for political reasons as well. And for insurance coverage, we have to work with the hardest cases. So when I saw MDMA-AT in that paper, and I'm the last author, Bessel's the first author, I said, let's ditch this. This is not any more completely controlled by Lykos. Mm-hmm. This is a scientific paper. And so Bessel agreed, Michael and Annie agreed, all the therapists that are on the paper agreed that, and MAPS never uses MDMA-AT.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So once the therapist decided to change all that in the paper, then they had to get approval in a way of Lykos. And finally Lykos agreed to do that. And then they have since reaffirmed that. So how you think about things and the words that you use is really important for our public education. When Janssen, owned by Johnson & Johnson, made esketamine into a medicine, this is what I'm worried about. So esketamine, when you don't give it with therapy, it doesn't work as well. The results tend to fade, but that's good for the pharma company because then you need more esketamine.
Yeah.
You need to buy more of the medicine. When you combine it with therapy, you can help people integrate it more.
Yeah.
The results are more durable.
Yeah.
And the pharma company doesn't make any money on the psychotherapy.
Yeah.
So Lykos will not make any money on the psychotherapy either.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, in a sense, the revenue model is selling MDMA.
Right, right.
But it's within a therapeutic context. And so there will be some studies, I think, coming up comparing esketamine with and without therapy. But they're not something that's a priority for the pharma company.
Yeah.
And the clinics that are operating make money off the therapy.
Off the therapy,
as well,
right.
As the drug. But the MDMA-AT also just had this flavor of it's just traditional pharma thinking like esketamine, which is what we want to avoid.
Well, I'm glad you called me out on it. I appreciate that.
Then there's another complexity to this,
Please.
Which is that MAPS, the nonprofit that's, you know, I started 38 years ago. 2014 was the Benefit Corp, with now Lykos, but MAPS wants to legalize MDMA without any therapy as fundamental human right for people to be able to alter their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say these arguments that are, I think, increasingly getting some credibility, that freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, all of those are secondary to freedom of thought. And freedom of thought implies being able to use drugs or whatever you want to use. And so I think this statement that I'm trying to say about it's a therapy company and the therapists need training. And so if that's because we want insurance coverage for it and we want to get the best possible outcomes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we need all sorts of people to, I think, have access in a regulated way, but legal access to do on their own. And instead of providing therapy, what we want to do is, when I talk about regulated, I think there should be a license to buy drugs like that. And then the more important point about the license is that if you misbehave, it gets taken away for a period of time, and then you have to get some educational thing. So like drunk drivers can lose their driver's license, can still go buy alcohol, go to a bar, or go to a liquor store. And so if you needed a license to buy it, then when you're a drunk driver, then it's harder for you to get alcohol.
Right, right.
And so I think in a regulated context like that for adults, and I think the way it should be for kids, is that we want to be the family values, mm-hmm. meaning that it should be up to the parents to decide. So it should be illegal for minors, legal for adults, mm-hmm. but a parental override. Mm-hmm. As compared to, you know, I've got three kids, but they're 29, 27, 25. But when they were in high school here in Belmont, when they're getting ready for the prom or different kind of things, the school calls the parents in and they say, if you provide a safe place for your kid and their friends to do alcohol, if anything goes wrong, you're going to jail. You should not do that. Push them away. Do
oh,
not.
Wow. I thought you were
going to
say the opposite. I thought you were going to say they'll come to you and say, please provide a safe space.
No, they're the opposite. They're saying, do not host a party in your basement. Because if one of these kids goes out and mm-hmm. you know, crashes a car or something, then you could go to jail. And you could go to jail for long periods of time. And this is so they go against this whole idea of safe places with parental supervision. And my son, who's the oldest, went to school at McGill. Montreal, they have an 18-year-old drinking age.
Yeah.
The RAs started a beer pong.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not the kind of thing that they sneak out for. And when you sneak out, you tend to get the more powerful alcohol that you can do it as fast as possible. And it leads to bad problems. So anyway, I think that all that I'm saying about therapy and the importance of therapist training is in this medicalized context where insurance, we have to justify insurance covering the therapy. And I do think that there's a lot of people that don't have a diagnosis. Like I do not have, as far as I know, a diagnosis, but I've benefited enormously from my MDMA experiences mm-hmm. and from my LSD experiences, mm-hmm. from all these psychedelic experiences that I've had. Maybe it's even prevented me from getting a diagnosis.
Yeah.
So there should be honest drug education, pure drugs. There should be this regulated licensing idea, and there should be harm reduction and also peer support.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be training people to help each other when somebody has a difficult experience with psychedelics.
Right.
So I just want to make that distinction that MAPS has this long-term goal, which is mass mental health and a spiritualized humanity. And one path is through medicalization.
Yeah.
The other path is through drug policy reform.
Right. Appreciate that full view context. So let's go into like where we currently are right now. Is it February? It's February 2024.
Yes, I believe it is.
It is February 2024. So Lyco submitted the new drug application in December
11th,
2023, after 38 years of plotting progress. Congratulations, by the way. Appreciate your...
Yeah, 37 and a half, actually.
Your efforts there.
Yeah.
I would love for a succinct encapsulation of like what comes next, right? There's a lot of like negotiations and decisions and uncertainties. It's not just a stamp of approval. There's nuances like REMS and drug labeling and who needs to be in the room, which have massive second order consequences in terms of reimbursement and stuff. So however you want to take that, that's where I really am sort of super interested in your...
Okay. So December 11th is when the complete data package with all the data from our phase 3 studies, all the ancillary studies FDA wanted, long-term follow-up studies, our phase 2 data, all that was submitted to the FDA. FDA has 2 months to review the file and decide whether it's sufficient, whether all of the information, not whether they will approve it or not, but whether all the information is there that they're going to need to review.
Have they done that yet?
No. So that's got to be done by around the 11th or 12th, just in within a week or so from this discussion that we're having now.
Yep.
And if they accept the file, then there is likely to be a 6-month priority review.
Mm-hmm. So a 6-month priority review is normally these things are like a 10-month review, right?
Yeah.
And the 6-month, is that on account of the special protocol assessment?
Well, not the special protocol assessment so much, but the breakthrough therapy designation.
Therapy. Okay.
And all the indications are that we will get a priority review.
Yeah.
That will be announced once they say we accept the file.
Right.
And this is so.
But then that 6 months starts when they start asking questions.
No. The 6 months starts when they accept the file.
Okay, got it.
Okay,
thanks.
And then when they start asking, and they've already asked lots of questions in this 2-month period to make sure that all the data is there. But then they'll ask some other question, and then, you know, there's more than 100 people at Lycos, and they will be trying to address the questions as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, then phase three was in Israel, Canada, and the United States. Mm-hmm. And so we've got the sense from Ministry of Health in Israel and Health Canada, and most countries around the world, will look to FDA to go first. So what we think will happen is that there's a very good chance that somewhere around August, September, if all goes well, FDA may grant access for prescription use of MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD. And then I'll get into the REMS and stuff back. But then what happens is that the Drug Enforcement Administration has to reschedule.
Yeah.
And it used to be that they would take a very long time and they weren't so thrilled by doing it anyway. Yeah. So now they have a 90-day clock.
Yeah.
So DEA must reschedule within 90 days.
And that's rescheduling of the GMP product.
In the encapsulated form.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that the MDMA itself, it's called bifurcated scheduling.
Right.
And so the MDMA itself will probably stay in Schedule 1.
Yeah.
And we're proposing Schedule 3. And we think we've got a lot of good arguments for that. And then what happens is that the states need to reschedule as well.
Mm-hmm.
And a bit more than half the states will more or less automatically reschedule.
Yeah.
Some that required laws, we've gone ahead proactively and passed laws in Colorado, Arizona, California, and New York. And then others need the board or pharmacy to do something or a different kind of review thing. So we think there's a good chance that by the end of 2024 or the early 2025, there could be the first prescription use.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear exactly how long, but shortly after that should be Israel and Canada. One of the interesting things about Brexit for England is that they need to show that they got something from it. And one of the things that they're showing, they claim to show, is that they can move faster than the European Medicines Agency.
Right, yeah.
And so England was one of the first, if not the first, to approve the vaccines.
Yeah.
And they're really proud of that.
Yeah.
So we think that there's a real good chance that the MHRA will be well before Europe.
Yeah.
And we have done studies in small groups of people without control groups, but at King's College with MDMA for PTSD. And then we want to globalize. And so what MAPS is doing, I just came back from Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and we're trying to bring MDMA-assisted therapy to the Arab world. We do already have projects in Israel, and we're just starting to explore group therapy in Israel and also at the Portland, Oregon VA. All right, so then all of that now raises the question of how.
Yeah.
All right, so I believe, and our therapists believe, that they are better as therapy if they have received MDMA themselves in a therapeutic setting. So the FDA, about 15 years ago, actually gave us permission for a protocol to give MDMA to therapists as part of their training. And I thought that was really the sign that they were going to give us a fair chance, that we could fully train the therapist the way we wanted to get the best results.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we were training people for research, where some people get a placebo therapy with inactive placebo, some people get therapy with full dose MDMA. So this MT1 protocol, MDMA therapy 1, was a 4-day long process where people either get a placebo or MDMA, they don't know what, for an 8-hour session with two therapists, usually male, female, then a day of integration, then the crossover, and then another day of integration.
Yeah.
So it's a 4-day. And we've taken around 125 people through that, so almost all of the therapists working on phase three have had their own MDMA experiences. Then, thinking ahead, we wanted to change the protocol to make it 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
So eliminate the placebo and the day of integration after that and make it easier, because now we want to train 25,000 therapists by the end of 2030. And how do we do that? And so we submitted this protocol to the FDA. Meanwhile, Tom Laughren, who is the director of psychiatry products at FDA, had retired. There's a new group of people there that are making decisions, and I think this idea is a little bit confusing to them about therapists getting their own MDMA experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was that this is now a bit more than 2 years ago, the FDA said, no, we will not give you permission for this study. And not only that, we'll never give you permission for the study, and not only that, but your people are not qualified. That the lead therapist needs to be an MD or a PhD. Of the two-person team?
Of the entire MDMA project.
Yeah.
Of all clinical site research.
Yeah. Okay, so, and also you need a doctor on site.
Wow.
All right, this is a poison pill for the whole
industry. Yeah,
so let me go back, since you mentioned the special protocol assessment process. So November 29th, 2016 is when FDA said, yes, you can go to phase three.
Yeah.
But we did not go to phase three because I knew there's challenges to how do you do a double-blind study. So we elected, and many pharma companies don't do that, we elected to go through a special protocol assessment process. Mm-hmm. It took us about 8 months. The goal of it is to get what's called an agreement letter,
mm-hmm.
where that FDA agrees on the protocol design, the statistical analysis plan, mm-hmm. all of the ways that they want to see safety data gathered, mm-hmm. all of that. And it was a long process, but in the end, we did get an agreement letter.
Yeah.
So what that means, basically, is that the FDA is legally bound to approve your drug if the design that you negotiated with them gets statistically significant evidence of efficacy, if there's no new safety problems that come up that they weren't aware of when they designed this, and if you gathered the data in a proper way that can withstand FDA audit. And so they cannot make changes to this protocol unless there's safety signals. All right, so that was near the end of 2017, and then we started phase three in 2018. Around this time, now we have cleared out some of the regulatory obstacles. This began the rise of the for-profit psychedelic companies.
Yeah.
It also helped put FDA on notice that other companies were going to come, that psychedelics yeah. were coming in multiple, particularly psilocybin.
Yeah.
So two main companies, Compass Pathways mm-hmm. for psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, and USONA, more mm-hmm. of a nonprofit for major depressive disorder, they started coming to the FDA mm-hmm. for different protocols
mm-hmm.
that were now clearly in the drug development range.
Yeah.
And the FDA started saying, okay, MD, PhD has to be the lead person and you need a doctor on site. And so these companies agreed to that. And the reason that they agreed to that...
The MD, PhD as in the room?
Like, in the room as the lead therapist.
MD, PhD.
MD or PhD.
Oh, I should say, gosh. Sorry. Yeah,
yeah, MD like, or
wow,
PhD.
That's a unicorn.
Yeah, MD or PhD, and then the physician on site.
Mm.
And now the reason that these companies did it is that I have a different approach in that I'm not particularly impressed by academic settings.
Yeah.
And they're good. You need them for credibility.
Sure.
But most of our research has taken place outside of academic yeah. settings in private practice clinics.
Yeah.
They're more comfortable. Yeah. They're designed more conducive to psychedelic sessions.
Sure.
They're not as noisy.
Yep.
They're just better.
The lighting's better.
Yes, it's not all fluorescent lights.
Yeah.
You can go outside you know, at night. Often we have overnight stays.
Yeah.
So, however, Compass and USONA tend to think academic. And so you've got loads of MDs or PhDs wandering around and mm-hmm. doctors are nearby.
Mm-hmm.
So they agreed to these things. And they just said, let's not fight the FDA. Let's, you know, I'm used to realizing that the FDA does not make its decisions strictly based on the science. There's a whole political, cultural overlay.
You don't say.
Yes.
Oh.
Well, I think one of the main limitations, I would say, of the way in which Lykos is thinking about things is the misunderstanding that it's all about the data.
Yeah.
So the data is necessary but not sufficient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If it were about the data, MDMA would have never been criminalized in the first place.
Right.
Right, so we got USONA and Compass agreeing to these things. So then mm-hmm. MAPS comes along with this new protocol, and so FDA now tries to impose on us the new restrictions that they could not impose on phase three because we were protected by the special protocol assessment, but for new protocols going forward, and I worried that they would think of this as a potential model for post-approval.
Yeah.
All right, so we submitted bunches of information. We looked at the sites that had MD or PhD as the lead therapist compared to the ones that didn't. No significant difference in efficacy.
Yeah.
The ones that had doctor on site and no doctor on site, mm-hmm. you know, doctor is always on call, but either doctor on site or doctor on call, no differences in safety.
Yeah.
And we submitted this information to the FDA multiple times and they started ignoring it. They just kept saying no, but they didn't respond in a scientific way to the data we presented.
Yeah.
So the signal for us was that what this meant, and we need to think of FDA as a bureaucracy, is that the people in the division level didn't want to take responsibility for making a decision that now, you know, you don't really need MD or PhD.
Right.
And they wanted to show that they were being responsible. The other thing in the background to realize is that the division of psychiatry has gone through different evolutions bureaucratically. And back in the 90s, the same sort of historical division approved OxyContin.
I was going to just ask, was that where the opioid approval came from?
Yes, because they worked with psychedelics and Schedule I drugs and other things. So they're aware that everything they do can be subpoenaed, can be used in criminal trials and civil trials. So they're concerned about making a decision.
Right.
And it's classic, and it's in the military, it's in the bureaucracy. Yeah. Even bureaucracies that we've created, you know, people at the lower level don't want to take responsibility for a decision. So we got the sense from FDA that they would not hold it against us if we hired lawyers that specialize in what's called formal dispute resolution process with the FDA. So these are like lawyer scientists.
Yeah.
So we spent over $250,000 on legal fees, and we did do one of these formal dispute resolution requests. We worked with lawyers from Hyman Phelps, a big DC law firm, and we won 100%. So we knocked out MD-PhD.
On the issue of MD-PhD.
On the issue of, would they give us a protocol to give MDMA to train therapists? On the issue of MD PhD, and on the issue of doctor on site or on call. So now we do not need a doctor on, or we never really did. Going forward for other studies, doctor does initial screening,
right,
but then is on call.
Yeah.
And not only did we win, but we won for the entire field. So that then started with, you know, Roland Griffiths at Hopkins started contacting me about how does he change the kind of ways that they did.
Yeah.
And so now the psilocybin people don't need doctor on site.
Awesome.
Nor do they need MD, PhD as the lead therapist. So this is all to back into the question about how. Okay, so the how is that there will be clinics. Ideally, there will be clinics with therapists that are cross-trained with ketamine, with MDMA, with psilocybin, and there will not need to be a doctor on site or MD, PhD. Currently, what the FDA is saying is that the lead person, it's still, whether they will require two people in the room or not, I hope that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the outcomes are so great that insurance companies should cover it.
Yeah.
So the first person needs to be licensed to do therapy.
Yeah.
And the second person right now for our studies does not need to be licensed, needs to be a bachelor's degree.
Right.
Or and have 1,000 hours behavioral health experience. I think we should knock both of those out over time.
Mm-hmm.
And Naropa, which is a Buddhist school in Boulder, Colorado, they've now created a associate degree. So it's from high school, but it's 2 years. It's not a college degree. It's an associate degree in what they're calling psychedelic peer support.
Oh, brilliant.
So it's a really new way, because I do would like to see this two-person team retained, but I think the more that we can reduce the cost of
that
and have this be like an apprenticeship model.
So is this something that could be a decision handed down in this decision-making process?
Yeah.
Who needs to be in the room and their interest?
Yeah. So this now, we also say that there needs to be training of the therapists. So it's not clear that the FDA will say, in fact, it's pretty clear the FDA will not say, this is the exact training, here's the core competencies.
Yeah,
They will leave that to the sponsor. The sponsor is the one that runs the risk.
Right.
If the training is not proper and the bad outcomes happen, they could pull the drug off the market.
Yeah.
So the training, in our view, has three parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first part is roughly a six-day retreat, a residential retreat, for around 50 people at a time, with two trainers and three or four or five assistants.
Mm-hmm.
We have a standardized treatment manual. Mm-hmm. We call it inner-directed therapy, meaning that we support what's emerging. It's not like imposed on the top, like guided
CBT
imagery.
Or something like that.
It's not this technique. It's also with prolonged exposure, some things that you have to have what's called an index trauma. You pick one trauma out of all of them, and that's what all the measurements are made on. That's often re-traumatizing for people.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say, the VA did a study that they published last year that was 916 veterans, and they compared prolonged exposure with cognitive processing therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Prolonged exposure showed slightly better results, but roughly 50% of the people dropped out of the study in both arms.
Oh, wow.
Because the therapy itself was re-traumatizing.
Right.
And because also they're saying, here's the index trauma. Just talk about this trauma over and over and over till you get desensitized to it.
Yeah.
And then you're not able to get in there and say, oh, I had this beautiful experience.
Right.
You know, and that gave me stress. So in an MDMA experience that lasts 8 hours, people can have their minds can wander wherever.
Yeah, right.
And we believe in this inner healing intelligence. So anyway, the first part of the training is the 6-day program. Then the second is optional, where we need to create context for people to take MDMA
mm-hmm.
as part of their training. And our therapists all say it's tremendously important for
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
both personally and professionally. And then the third part of the training is supervision
mm-hmm.
or consultation. So that's where we're going to now insist that new therapists who've never treated a PTSD patient before, that their first patients are videotaped.
Yeah.
And then we have what are called adherence raters that watch the videotapes and quantify, according to core competencies, mm-hmm, how well mm-hmm. people are adhering to the method, work with supervisors, give the feedback to the therapist. And once that feedback has done it and we are satisfied that the therapists know the method that has been used in phase 3, then they're off on their own. And the same way that doctors can prescribe off-label, mm-hmm. therapists don't have to stick with the method that we've taught them.
Yeah, got it.
They can add guided imagery, or they can combine it with EMDR.
But what you just described, this training retreat, and it would be facilitated by Lykos, but is separate from any kind of
decision-making. Well, the FDA will not specify this is the content of the training.
Yeah.
They will leave that to the sponsor, and the sponsor can say, we insist on videotapes.
Yeah,
and we
okay.
want to review.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we also might say, we don't think you've learned it.
Yeah.
And now you need to do
right.
a second patient.
Yeah.
Or we think you'll never learn it. Or we think you should take a year off.
Right,
and
right,
go meditate
right.
or do
right.
whatever. Go take
yeah.
more MDMA yourself or whatever. You know, go to Beckley Waves and, you know, get some psilocybin or something. You know, who knows what. All right, so I think that there will be no limit on off-label prescription
yeah.
for things other than PTSD. People have said, oh, because it's a controlled substance, maybe the FDA would limit it just to PTSD. The DEA tried that around 1986 when Marinol, the oral THC pill, was approved for nausea control for cancer chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And they proposed a final rule that said that because it's a controlled substance, that there can be no off-label prescriptions.
Yeah.
And there was such an outcry from the pharmaceutical industry that they had to back off.
Yeah, interesting.
So there is no justification, no precedent for FDA to say you can only use this for this thing. Now, Congress for methadone, you know, did impose certain kind of limitations. So if it moves out of FDA to Congress, then Congress can do whatever, but I don't think they're going to do anything. So I think the idea is that there will be training mentioned, but the training will be left to the sponsor. Lykos doesn't want to be the only one doing the training.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The long-term goal is eventually when psilocybin becomes a medicine, MDMA, esketamine already, this should be standard training when you become a therapist. So it should be eventually exported these trainings into academia. And also we want to train other people to provide the training. So we're going to do train the trainers.
Yeah, yeah.
The other big point is that Lykos, as a public benefit but for-profit pharmaceutical company, will have a patient assistance program for people that can't pay
right.
that will help some people. Yeah. But mostly, they're going to work with people that are either self-pay, of which there's a smaller amount, than mm-hmm. insurance. MAPS, is the nonprofit, is going to go around the world and work on humanitarian projects.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been contacted by people in Rwanda, for example, and Somaliland and South Africa and Ukraine and elsewhere. And so when you have roughly, for example, 2 million or so Ukrainian refugees in Poland, and they do have some therapists, but they don't have real specific requirements to be a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be an abundance of people that need healing and a lack of psychiatrists and therapists. So we're going to have to find new models of local practitioners of different kinds and probably group therapy in a lot of different contexts. So what I'm talking about now is what the FDA is going to be saying for, you know, what I think is going to go for how Lykos moves forward.
Yeah.
And then wherever that gets spread, Canada, Israel, you know, MHRA, other things. But MAPS is going to be doing more humanitarian projects and looking at new models, new kind of things. And that's not going to be controlled by FDA. That will be controlled by the local countries and what they agree to let happen.
Got it.
So one of our fundraising team is gay and said that in the 80s, when the AIDS epidemic was at its worst and people were like a death sentence, they worked out a lot of their grief and trauma on the dance floor with ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
So when people think about these distinctions, this is medical, this is, quote, recreational, there's, I think, a misunderstanding that a lot of recreational use, people are self-medicating.
Yeah.
And that can be very helpful, and they can do that without, you know, therapists sitting on top of them.
Sure.
But they have to understand more about what the psychedelics can do. So this is just an example. I've said this before, but now around 15 years ago, two women contacted us in the same week with similar kind of stories, but different outcomes. Both of them had taken MDMA at a rave, dance parties, and had remembered trauma from the past. And one woman was with a bunch of friends who were just out to party, and she knew they didn't really want to hear about what she was going through, and that would, so she stuffed her feelings down, but it brought them, had brought them to the surface. And she said months later, she was worse off. The other woman said, similar thing happened, similar kind of memories of sexual abuse, and she was there with a girlfriend. They went off into the corner.
Yeah,
they talked about it for an hour. She worked through a lot of it.
It was a cathartic experience.
Yeah, and then she thought, aha, MDMA could be good for PTSD. So she thought she wanted to tell the world, and she did a Google search, and she found out we were doing research.
Yeah,
that she wasn't the first one to think MDMA could be good for PTSD.
And, yeah.
And so that's why she shared this story with us.
Yeah.
So I think that there's going to be a lot of education that's going to be needed to accompany non-medical access, just to round out this discussion about what's happening. In America now, there is an enormous growth of psychedelic churches and new psychedelic religions.
Yeah.
And they might not meet the IRS definition of a religion, but there's basically a concern by the police and the DEA that who knows what the courts would say. The courts are now really supporting religious freedom in all these different ways. You can now discriminate against people who you don't like, and you don't have to provide services to them. So there's this growth of psychedelic religions that, again, are without therapy context, often can be group context. So I think there'll be a lot of different modalities that people will have this. And what we're doing with the FDA will really only control you know, prescriptions with medicalized coverage. The big thing about group therapy, even in a Lykos perspective, is that we've now started projects where instead of two therapists or one therapist and an unlicensed person for one patient, in two cases, we've switched that to where there's two people in the room, but two people also getting MDMA. So there's this approach called cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy. So it's an approach to treating PTSD, but you bring in the PTSD person and their partner, and then they both get the therapy. And so this was back in 2014 where the FDA, we were still working with the FDA, not ready for group therapy, but with the VA, they said that if we wanted to work with VA therapists, that they would propose that we do this cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy, but that it couldn't be in the VAs. They wouldn't refer subjects. There could be no direct affiliation, and that we'd have to pay for it. But we did some of these studies with Candace Monson and Ann Wagner, who helped develop cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy, and the results where both get MDMA were tremendous. Really more reductions in PTSD than they had gotten from cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy without MDMA, and improvement in the relationships also. Then at Sunstone Therapies, which is in Rockville, they've done work with cancer patients and their partners both getting MDMA. And that also was really great. So now at Portland, Oregon VA, where we're starting group therapy, there's going to be four therapists for six veterans with PTSD. So the ratio was from 2-to-1 to 1-to-1, and now it's, you know, 1-to-1.5. And there'll be three cohorts of that. And they're all going to get two MDMA experiences. And the way it's designed is the first MDMA experience that these veterans are going to receive is going to be individual. And then only the second is in a group.
These are all separate from the current NDA that's that the FDA has sitting on their desk, right?
Exactly. And also for political reasons and also science and therapy reasons, we have approached the various experts in the non-drug psychotherapies for PTSD, with prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral conjoint therapy. And what we've said is that MDMA is just a tool.
Yeah.
And we have, we think, optimized the approach with our inner-directed therapy, but it can be used in any number of these different approaches.
Yeah.
So there will be studies, mostly inside the VA, combining MDMA with prolonged exposure, combining it with cognitive processing therapy.
Yeah.
So all of that is really to reinforce this idea, is that once we've trained people in the method that we used in phase three, then they can
There'll be some experimentation or off-label use of therapeutic modalities.
Yeah, although I don't think the label will say that it must, it'll say only under direct supervision of therapists,
right.
But it probably will not say only inner-directed.
Yeah, only inner-directed.
Yeah. So what we have wanted to do, and I wish that the FDA was wise enough to do this, I don't know, is that a pharma company cannot knowingly sell off-label, but doctors can prescribe off-label. So Peter Barton Hutt, who's the leading pharmaceutical lawyer in America in his 80s and was the FDA lawyer, he suggested that we negotiate with FDA and say that the label should say MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD by trained therapists whose training can include one MDMA session. If they're willing to put that language in there, then giving MDMA to a therapist is now on the label. And so then we can do that outside of research, and then we can pick, here's our 150 best therapists, and we authorize all of these to give MDMA to therapists as part of their training if they want to do that. It should always be optional, never required. But what I'm really hoping for, but I don't know whether it will turn out this way, is that we get this language in the label. It would be a decision that the division will not make. It would have to be more senior levels of the FDA. But I'm appealing to the FDA, whoever senior levels are listening now, hopefully some of them will, they're on the hook too. You know, if MDMA becomes a medicine, and if the outcomes are not so good, then it's going to look bad for the FDA. And if the outcomes are not so good, in part because therapists have not even had their own MDMA experience. We had one therapist who was on phase three, partnered with someone who had done MDMA, but she had never done MDMA. And she was scheduled for this MT1 for her own MDMA experience between the first and the second MDMA experience for the patient.
Yeah.
And she described how she was much better in the second.
She was a better therapist after having
MDMA. Yeah. And then the supervisors saw it in the videotapes as
Interesting.
Well. So hopefully the FDA will realize that it makes sense for them to put this onto the label.
Yeah,
because we, but therapists, a lot of them will want their own MDMA experience.
Right,
and we don't want to drive them underground to have to do it illegally.
Totally.
Particularly when we work with therapists in the ministry, in the, you know, the VA,
the VA,
or the Department of Defense. Or, a lot of therapists don't want to break the law to have their own MDMA experience. And right now, with psilocybin, because you know, you could go to Jamaica, you could go to the Netherlands, you can go to Costa Rica, and a lot of the new drug policy reform initiatives that are happening involve natural plant medicines that are legalized. So we have the Oregon Psilocybin Initiative, natural plant medicine. Colorado, it's going to be on the ballot here in Massachusetts in November. There's a legislative effort going through California. But in general, what happens is that people have this romantic attachment to plants.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, okay, but then you add MDMA or LSD and it doesn't pass.
Right.
So right now there's nowhere in the world where some therapist could go to have a legal experience with MDMA. There are certain areas in British Columbia where it's decriminalized. Portugal has decriminalized drugs too. But, but so therapists can go places to get a psilocybin experience, but they cannot. So with MDMA right now. So to drive them underground or to force us to do it in a protocol where we have to gather all sorts of information just makes it very expensive.
Right, right.
So anyway, so that's what I hope for the label, that the label will say MDMA-assisted therapy by trained therapists whose training can include one MDMA session.
That would be incredible. I'd never thought, I'd never conceived of that likelihood or possibility being part of the drug label. That makes it really
Well, this was from the foremost pharmaceutical lawyer who was, by the way, on my dissertation committee.
Interesting.
He writes the textbook. I took his class at Harvard Law School and pretended to be a lawyer. And did good enough that he became my dissertation advisor. So I think there's a difference between people who understand that these policies are all fluid.
Yeah.
You know, versus people who are in organizations where they're supposed to implement what's already done. They don't think as creatively as people who create the rules.
Right, right.
So, yeah, so there is that possibility. How likely it is that the FDA is going to go for that, I think it's a bit of a long shot.
So there's a lot that goes into like the next handful of months in terms of like the decisions and negotiations. Paint a picture of what the next 2 to 5 years looks like from a, like a clinical commercialization perspective. Because I imagine that Lykos has to be working kind of on the one hand, on the regulatory side, and on the other hand, preparing for commercialization.
What
goes into that process? It's not just like drug manufacturing, and because of the scheduling, there's probably some limitations there, REMS, where these things can be facilitated.
Yeah. Will there be a patient registry? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where everybody is. One of the things that both the FDA is interested in and insurance companies are interested in is the durability of the effects and then the rate of relapse.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all effects? And then can we figure out how to predict ahead of time who is going to respond and who's not going to respond?
Right.
So that would be a tremendous thing if we can figure that out. We had an 88% response rate.
Right, right.
In our first phase 3 study, I think it was 87% in the second phase 3 study. Uh-huh. So, and there's response means two things. One is that you no longer have a diagnosis for PTSD, or you have clinically significant reduction of PTSD symptoms, even if you still retain a diagnosis.
And diagnosis is an interview, right? Like the CAPS-5?
Well, the CAPS-5 is not the same as a diagnosis for PTSD. Mm-hmm. So, so that the CAPS-5 is the gold standard, and it's an hour-long interview by independent raters.
Got it. So that's more of a research tool than a diagnostic tool.
Yeah, although it's very helpful for a diagnosis, but it's not exactly the same.
Got it.
Right, so I think over the next 2 to 5 years, so from a business point of view, the big question for Lykos is when do we come cash flow positive? Hard to say, but I guess it would be near the beginning of 2026. Because as you start to market, you still have all these infrastructure costs and all your staff and all of this. So it takes a while for there to be a number of trained therapists and a number of prescriptions and insurance coverage to hit cash flow positive. My guess is that almost all the states will be rescheduled within 6 months after a DEA says yes. Mm-hmm. I think that there's going to be in the neighborhood, I'd say by 2030 or so, that there could be roughly 6,000 or so psychedelic clinics.
And when you say psychedelic clinic, do you mean at academic centers? No. Do you mean owned by neuropsychiatrists?
I mean, like, some will be at academic centers, some will be at big healthcare providers, some will be different ways, but I think a lot of it will be the way therapy is currently practiced. Many therapists work out of their houses or work out of small offices. Yeah. You know, there'll be some special considerations to store a controlled substance. So that'll be a big issue is does it get sent to the patient? Yeah. Does it get sent to the pharmacy? Does it get sent to the treatment
center? That's something
center?
That gets negotiated in this process, right?
Yeah. How does the drug flow? There needs to be what's called pharmacovigilance. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of what actually happens when it goes into the real world. Because in research, it's pretty controlled and you have a lot of inclusion and exclusion criteria. Yeah. You're picking sort of pure cases. So one of the big frustrations for me, which I think will change, is that the FDA has said that for all of our research, we cannot work with people with a dual diagnosis of PTSD and substance use disorder. We have to enroll people that have had 2 months of no substance use disorder. I think that's really foolish because we wanted to work with the hardest cases.
Right.
Of the people that are in our studies with PTSD, 90% of them have depression as well. But I think over time there will be, over the next couple of years, move more and more to people that have this dual diagnosis with substance use disorder. One of the biggest things that I think we will need to do over time, and there's really good positive indications that this might work, is that we require people to taper off their psychiatric medications in order to be in the study. The SSRIs and psychiatric medications tend to blunt the effects of MDMA.
Mm-hmm.
And with S-ketamine, it has the advantage of you can give it to people already on their meds.
Yeah.
So, for example, somebody attempts suicide and they go to the emergency room, and they're still taking all these medicines, you can give them ketamine. Just to blast S-ketamine a little bit. Years ago, I had the opportunity with a person I know, separated the isomers of ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
So I did both of them,
mm-hmm.
actually some with John Lilly.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, wow.
Our opinion and others were that the racemic,
yeah.
the general, where they're sort of, they crystallize right hand, left
yeah,
hand,
yeah.
more or less 50-50 proportions. Yeah. And the drugs that we know are the ones that are have half and half.
Yeah.
But if you take one of the half, so Janssen decided that they would take S-ketamine because they could patent it.
Oh, wow.
Because racemic ketamine,
yeah.
the mixture has
it's
long
in the public
gone
yeah.
generic and it yeah. costs a dollar or two, whereas yeah. Spravato can be hundreds of dollars.
Right.
More and more of the clinics are now prescribing racemic ketamine off-label.
Yeah.
But I think that this idea of psilocybin is also has been requiring people to taper off their SSRIs.
Yeah.
And they're starting to think maybe that's not necessary.
Right, right.
So in underground settings, we've heard anecdotal reports about people that have worked with people with PTSD or depression
mm-hmm.
who are on SSRIs, and then you give higher doses of MDMA, and then some fraction of them seems like
yeah.
they can have a pretty full MDMA experience.
Right.
So I think what we will need to be doing is a dose response safety study
mm-hmm.
with people on SSRIs
yeah.
to give increasing doses of MDMA to see if you can help them have more of a full MDMA experience without getting what's called serotonin syndrome.
Right.
And there's good theoretical reasons to believe that that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a bunch of anecdotal reports that
yeah.
that can be done. So anyway, that'll be one of the things that we'll be thinking about over the next 2 to 5
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's, I think, tremendously important is working with people under 18 with
mm-hmm.
the adolescent study.
Mm-hmm.
So the FDA has said that if indeed they do approve us to work with adults, which are 18 years or older, we don't have an upper age limit.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lower age limit right now of 18, but no upper age
mm-hmm.
limit. It's more about hearts and MDMA increases blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about general health
yeah.
and age. But the FDA said is that if they do approve MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD for 18 or over, we are required to study adolescents, 13 to 17
yeah,
year olds.
Right, right.
And if that works, we have to go down to 7 to 12 year olds.
Oh, wow.
And the way insurance companies work, they look at quality adjusted life years, QALYs. And so the economics makes more sense the younger the person is because they have a longer of a lifespan to benefit from it. Also, one of the big arguments in promotion of the drug war
yeah.
and promotion of criminalizing marijuana is, oh, adolescents, their brains are still developing
yeah,
and
yeah.
they don't get fully developed till they're 24 or 25.
Right.
And so we have to keep them free of drugs because their brains are still
yeah.
developing. So, of course, that means nothing for ADHD drugs, which
yeah.
we give to little kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a drug war argument. It's
mm-hmm.
not a science argument. Because
mm-hmm.
just logically, if you've got somebody that is traumatized, their brains are not normal.
Yeah.
And if you can layer in peace, acceptance,
yeah.
you know, overcoming trauma and fear,
mm-hmm.
the sooner you do that, the better.
The better, yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to this idea of the adolescent studies.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you look at the cultures that have integrated psychedelics, the Native American church with
mm-hmm.
peyote or the ayahuasca churches,
mm-hmm.
I was at a Navajo reservation, Native American church service, and one of the Indians, Navajo, brought his 9-year-old son
mm-hmm.
to spend the night with us
mm.
doing peyote.
Wow.
He didn't do as much as everybody
yeah.
else. But there are no age limits in these
yeah.
traditional cultures. So the other part of this is the octopus study,
yeah.
which I'll just mention that Gould Dolan was a researcher at Johns Hopkins, and many people have probably seen the My Octopus Teacher,
mm-hmm.
which is a really great. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to see it. Octopuses are solitary creatures,
mm-hmm.
and they hang out by themselves until the end of their life when it's mating season, and then they look for other octopuses,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
shortly after that, they die.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll kill other octopuses sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
They're very solitary. But around 600 million years ago, humans and octopuses, the lines started going in different directions, but octopuses still process serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
So Go was wondering, what happens if you give MDMA to an
mm-hmm.
octopus and you have this experimental contraption where there's an octopus in the middle of this and there's two doors.
Mm-hmm.
One leads to another chamber
mm-hmm.
with the octopus in like a birdcage. So
yeah.
the second octopus
yeah.
can't move. And if they go the other direction, there's like a ball or a toy or
yeah.
something, inanimate object. And so the octopuses will spend way more time with the inanimate object.
Yeah.
And when they're with the other octopus exploring, they're just around the perimeter.
Yeah.
So it took a while for Gould to figure this out, but what is the optimal dose for octopus? But they figured out the doses, and you put it in the you put the MDMA in the water, you soak the octopus for 10 minutes in this water, then you put it in the contraption, and they spend more time with the octopus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And their tentacles are, you know, touching each other and stuff. So what that means is that the effect of, now this is a logical leap, of course, but the effect of MDMA is evolutionary conserved and pre-verbal.
Yeah, yeah.
So for kids who are not so articulate necessarily, I think MDMA will still work great.
Yeah.
So we will see. Also, there's some
sorry to cut you off, PTSD or other indications? Or?
Well, initially PTSD, but we did studies with adults with social anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So autistic adults with social anxiety, MDMA, I think, can be great for social anxiety. Mm-hmm. This is just a personal story, but when I was, I was so shy, I was scared of talking to girls. I just couldn't do it. So I think if I would have had MDMA when I was 13, also my bar mitzvah was a massive disappointment because I thought, oh, great, you know, turn me into a man and I'll see God and this will be terrific. And, you know, so this outer ritual, it was a nice party, but, you know, I'm in bed and the next morning, where's, you know, I'm the same. It's pathetic. And so I thought, okay, God's busy. Tomorrow it'll be different. And then tomorrow was no different. And then tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And then a whole week goes by and a whole new crop of people got bar and bat mitzvahed. And I figured I had just dropped off the list. So a lot of us have these rituals that may have worked
in the past,
but they don't work now. So I feel that I was at 13 really ready. And so my wife and I, when our kids turned 13, we said to them, we think that you're old enough now for MDMA or marijuana. And if you want some, come to us and we'll give it to you and it'll be pure and you can do it with us. So we did not realize that the concept of doing drugs with your parents would make them run the other way. So it was the best anti-drug strategy we could have figured out. Not that we were looking for an anti-drug strategy. But all this sort of summarizes that I think that not only is FDA requiring us to do these studies in adolescents if we're approved in adult, but they are also incentivizing us to do it. So that because Merck invented MDMA in 1912, MDMA is in the public domain. We hired the patent attorneys that patented Ibogaine for opiate disorder. And in the 80s, what happened is that everybody started suing each other for intellectual property.
Yeah.
So I hired the lawyers to develop an anti-patent strategy for MDMA so that nobody can patent the uses of MDMA unless it's some new thing that nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah.
And so what that basically...
Data exclusivity?
Data exclusivity is what we're relying on.
Yeah.
And... So this was actually signed into law in 1984 by Ronald Reagan. I didn't even know about it. I got my PhD in 2001, focusing on FDA regulation of the medical use of psychedelics and marijuana. I completely missed it.
Wow.
Pharma companies don't use it because they always want patents.
So
it's a little obscure thing that never gets used. So in the U.S., you get 5 years data exclusivity. In Europe now, it's basically 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And... in the U.S., if you do adolescent studies, they give you additional 6 months data exclusivity. And we don't have to get it approved for adolescents. We just have to study it in adolescents. And even if it doesn't work out, you get this additional 6 months. So in addition to working with people on SSRIs to do these dose-response safety studies, Lykos will be doing adolescent studies as well. And I think the group therapy model is going to be looked at a lot more. Whether it will be impossible to do group therapy under the REMS or off-label and risky or so is not clear, so that there may need to be a series of studies with group therapy that are then submitted to the FDA about a new model. So what's happening in Israel is that we're raising around with others, with the Psychedelic Science Funders Collaborative and others, around $2 million to support group therapy for people who were all traumatized together. So I should add that for the Portland, Oregon VA, there's two main ways that veterans have trauma. One is combat-related trauma. The other is called MST, military sexual trauma, where people, mostly women, but not only, are sexually abused,
yeah,
raped by other soldiers.
Yeah.
So we're going to do in the Portland, Oregon VA, it's going to be people traumatized in the same way working together. And so in Israel, it would be people traumatized at the Nova Rave or in the kibbutzim or in the army, different ways. So I think group therapy is going to be really important as well. And then there's many other potential uses of MDMA that, as I said, I don't think that there will be a prohibition against off-label prescriptions, but insurance companies might not cover it. Yeah. So Lykos should be doing studies with MDMA for a whole host of other indications as well.
I want to spend a little bit of time on Lykos and the migration from MAPS to Lykos. I have a sense you have a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
But I get the sense from what I've heard you say throughout, you know, my time studying this space. Mm. And my sense is that you have the sense that there is something rotten in the state of corporate regulatory affairs and regulatory capture or sort of matters that impact the healthcare system at a high level with regards to incentives and
patents,
patents and sentence of
lawsuits because of patents,
et cetera. And so this is my way of trying to get your take on maybe the state of affairs, broadly speaking, and maybe through the lens of the need to pivot from a wholly owned organization to a, because there was a bit of, what's the word? Not reluctance, but I can't remember the word you said in your email that kind of announced it. It was bittersweet. You were a victim of your own success in one in one sense, because of the growth of the industry and the investment opportunities.
Yeah,
but also because there is going to be some trade offs with entering the market in this way.
Yeah. So, what I had wanted to do was to be entirely powered by philanthropy, and then once it becomes a medicine, then it's really about public benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Once I learned about data exclusivity, then I realized, and I also realized how much money it costs. We've raised about $150 million or so in donations in this 37 and a half years. But what I realized is that how much money it costs to do both drug development and commercialization, and also how many other uses of MDMA there potentially are and how much money would be needed for that and other drugs as well. So once I learned about data exclusivity, I thought, okay, now we can go ahead and create a public benefit for-profit company. So public benefit is a modification of capitalism. Most companies that are not public benefit companies, all of them actually, you have to maximize shareholder value, you have to maximize profits. And minority shareholders can sue the management if they're not doing that. So I didn't want that. So I wanted a public benefit pharmaceutical company where public benefit would be maximized more than profit, and it would be 100% owned by the nonprofit. But I was not able to raise the funds that we needed entirely from philanthropy. So we've taken investors. Fortunately, we have the best possible investors, which what they mean is impact investors. So Lykos, in a traditional way, looked for a long time for biotech investors. And biotech investors basically turned their back on us because they don't like this idea of a nonprofit that cares about public benefit, not going to maximize profits. But also they said, you know, you don't have patent protection and you need longer periods of time. And so we ended up with impact investors that are terrific. And they really do care about impact as well as return on capital, but they're not looking 10x and get in and out, you know, and do an IPO and then they're gone. Nevertheless, when you have investors, they are not donating their money. And they want a return on their investment. And that, so we've had to make these trade-offs. So one of our potential donors that I spoke to described this great. He said, you're on the knife's edge of capitalism versus altruism. And so there's a number of ways in which that expresses itself that feel to me like the world's on fire and mental health crises are growing and we've got all these people in America motivated by fears and anxieties that are manipulated to make them hate external people and hate immigrants and all this stuff. And so I think this balance that we have to strike now between public benefit and return to shareholders is not optimal for the crisis that humanity is in. That's why I think we do need drug policy reform.
But wouldn't more MDMA prescriptions mean more money?
Yes.
Like, yeah. Help me understand why there's a conflict there. Like,
oh, okay. So first off, how do you price the drug? You know, so that monopoly pricing, now this is not what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But the idea of maximizing profits.
Monopoly pricing refers to the practice of maximizing the price within the window of time that a drug has, a company has a monopoly on the.
Well, it's maximizing patent. The profits. Mm-hmm. And there's a price at which that happens where you maximize the profits, but it doesn't maximize the number of patients that get access to it. Or for any commodity, you know, that there's the demand is cut off in a way because you have such a high price. Now, there's going to be two different prices when we need to think about price, but one is the price that people with insurance pay just through their copays, and then the other is the price that the insurance companies pay. But in America, unlike in much of Europe where there's national health care, we've got, you know, one third, a quarter, something like that, people that are underinsured or uninsured. And we can do patient assistance. But the thing is that every time you see an ad on TV for a drug, they'll always say at the end, oh, you know, if you can't afford patient it, contact a patient assistance program. But all of these drugs are pretty inexpensive to make.
Yeah.
The price doesn't reflect the cost of making it. It reflects the value.
Yeah.
So when a pharma company says, we're going to give patient assistance, they're just giving you the marginal value of what it costs to make the next bit of the drug. The problem where it's different for us is that this is a drug that's only administered under direct supervision of therapists. So if we give free drugs to people who can't afford it, if they can't afford the therapy, it doesn't do them any good. So let's say that just more or less made up, but it's around 4 or 5% of net revenue. Somewhere like that, we've been told, goes to patient assistance programs. So if Lykos hits industry average for patient assistance, we're going to be treating a much smaller number of patients because the drug can cost us very little, but the therapy could be $10,000. The drug could be $150. So it's going to be difficult for us to really... There's 13 million PTSD patients just in America. So that's one issue is pricing strategies, and we can only do so much good. You know, the issues are going to be also this question about where is the quality level of the therapists that we approve to be treating people? You know, it's one thing when you are training people for clinical research where if we don't get great results, it's not even going to become medicine at all. So what kind of requirements will Lykos insist on it, what level of the standard. And luckily we're talking about a quality launch, a slow quality launch. I think that's really important.
And MAPS, the nonprofit, has retained an outsized proportion of voting rights to
So again, this is because we have these ideal impact investors who believe that the contribution that the nonprofit makes to this whole field and the understanding we have is valuable to keep. So we appoint 6 of the 8 board members. We meaning the nonprofit board appoints 6 of the 8 board members and we have 10-to-1 voting shares. So we'll end up with less than half of the stock, but you know, we can go down to 10% of the stock and we still have
the,
you know, majority of voting shares. So one of the other issues though is in general, boards don't want to micromanage the management. And so one of the biggest issues for us right now, and this is, I think, directly on point, is that there's all these stock options that are being given to the Lykos people. That motivates them according to the stock price. So the most difficult thing that we're working on now is we need to develop quantifiable public benefit metrics and link them to bonuses and stock options. And if we don't do that, public benefit is just falls by the wayside, and it's focused on, oh, let's get our stock price up, which you can get by maximizing the price that doesn't heal the most people.
Yeah.
The other part of this is that there's a sense that was clear, but is now less clear, is who is part of the ecosystem that we're building and who is a competitor.
Yeah.
Now, this is not the position of Lykos, but they've hired some traditional pharma people to review all the slides that we use and all of that. And so I was told, this is just an example. Luckily, it was overruled, but just gives you a sense of the consciousness. So I talked about the formal dispute resolution that we won with MD, PhD, knocked out, no doctor on site. And I was using slide of that. And so the medical, regulatory, legal review, they said, don't show those slides of this formal dispute resolution. And I'm like, well, why not? And they said, well, you're helping our competitors. And I'm like, the psilocybin people are not our competitors. We're all building the psychedelic therapy ecosystem together. The more they do, it benefits everybody. And so luckily the senior management overruled, but there is this sense of who's the competitor and what are we really trying to accomplish? There's other issues related to risk analysis.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about humanitarian projects, particularly where cultures don't have a lot of therapists or psychiatrists, also people are in worse health, so that's going to be, quote, riskier to do group therapy with people that, you know. So, you know, to what extent is there going to be a fear-based response about riskier situations that have this humanitarian purpose? So there's a lot of issues. Transparency. I would have liked for the entire NDA package that we submitted to the FDA on December 11th to be made public. That's the way we did up to a few years ago. Everything we publish back and forth with the FDA is on our website in the public domain.
Interesting.
Well, pharma companies never do that.
Yeah.
I think it's something that we should do.
Yeah, yeah.
But now we're not doing that.
Yeah.
Some of that will be made public in the approval package.
Right.
But I thought it would be incredible to do this in real time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, it benefits everybody and they see what the negotiations. So there's different issues like that. So there's a series of ways where when you bring in investors and when you have different decision-making bodies, the balance between where public benefit and where return to shareholders is a different line. There's another issue that, you know, again, Lykos has put out this idea that they're open to patenting innovations. MAPS's approach was all in the public domain. I understand when you have investors that there can be this compromise where, you can patent innovations, but then how they're enforced or what they're, how that does. So previously we didn't have this idea.
Yeah.
Okay. So to get to your other
point. There's a creep that comes in.
Yeah. And so before we started recording, you heard me having some meetings that was expressing some of this tension and how that's expressed. On the other hand, the biggest loss to public benefit would be if we ran out of money and didn't make MDMA into medicine.
Right.
So, you know, it's okay to make these compromises in order to make sure that we deliver MDMA to become an FDA-approved medicine.
Yeah.
So the dream plan that I had is failed, but so much has succeeded in any case, and we've launched the whole field. But I do think that the clinic of the future, and this is where I'm saying that there'll be roughly 6,000 clinics, I think, by 2030. The reason I say that is that there's around that many hospice centers in America. So every town that's big enough to have a hospice center, that's for people that are at the end of life, that are dying.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a greater percentage of people that have mental health issues throughout their lifespan than people that just at their end of their life. So I think there'll be 6,000 or more clinics. And what we really want to do, and this is, again, somewhat different than profit-maximizing company, which is we want the therapist to be cross-trained with MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, 5-MeO-DMT, and we want them to customize the treatment for each patient.
Yeah, yeah.
Psychedelic medicine is the goal. And what we need to do, and what every other company needs to do, is to study one drug at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
So this gets to another point, which is that the underground therapists are way ahead of what's happening in the research.
Right.
And so I think that we have a debt to pay to underground therapists who have developed all sorts of understandings combining MDMA with LSD. Stan Grof has actually talked about the future of psychiatry. He thought would be MDMA, and then an hour later, 5-MeO-DMT.
Yeah,
so that you've got the safety base from MDMA, and then you can adjust with the vape pens as you dissolve and merge into the universe and things like that. So I think there'll be stuff like that. And I think the psychedelic clinics of the future will offer all these different range of drugs and customized treatments. So there's not going to be MDMA clinic here, ketamine clinic there, psilocybin clinic there.
Yeah.
And there'll also be drug policy reform. And I'll just say 2035 is when I think that we will end up with federal legalization of all psychedelics and leave it to the states. And the reason is because when we look at the polling and the pattern we've had from medical marijuana to marijuana legalization, one of the main reasons why people vote for marijuana legalization is because they know a medical marijuana patient. There's so much misinformation they don't know, but if somebody they know and trust says, hey, this helped control my nausea for the chemotherapy.
So that word of mouth really is the key.
Is the key, exactly. So 2035. And then to sort of give the bigger picture beyond just the 2 to 5 years or so. So for MAPS, April 8th, 2024 is our 38th anniversary. I will add that the universe has decided to celebrate our birthday. So it's a full solar eclipse through much of North America. There won't be another one for another 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And so there's going to be about 40 or 50,000 people gathering in multiple places, but one of them is going to be outside Austin, Texas, where it's under the path of totality, and we're going to have a psychedelic lecture series. So if people want to go, it's seetexaseclipse.com.
Nice.
But the vision has been make MDMA into a medicine, bring forth the field of psychedelic science and medicine and overcome all these restrictions. So now that that's a good chance of happening, we need a new vision. So the new vision is a world of net zero trauma by 2070.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so net zero trauma doesn't mean no trauma. What it means is that we're not adding to the burden of trauma on humanity as a whole. So now we're thinking about humanity and all the different countries and all, and 7 or so billion people. And there's both trauma that happens during your life, and then there's multi-generational trauma through epigenetic mechanisms. And so I think things are going to get worse on a humanity basis for the next 10, 20 years as we start seeing what's going on with climate change. You know, people are really good, myself as well, to procrastinate, to wait till the last minute to do things when in some ways it's going to be too late. So we're destroying massive amounts of the planet. The coral is, people predict 90% of it is going to go. There's a massive species distinction, and there's an estimate by 2050 that there could be 1 billion climate refugees. So I think if you could measure the trauma, and that's one of the things that we want to do. So Bhutan has got gross national happiness. We all know gross national product about the economic activity. There's all these different measures of different aspects on countries, depression, different mental illnesses. So we need a metric for gross national trauma that will take a couple $1 million to develop and then apply to each country. It could be as simple as the ACEs, which mean adverse childhood experiences, and you just track how many of them there are in each country, or it could be more sophisticated different ways. And so what we want to do is really, how do we get humanity to evolve to the point where we're not so burdened by trauma that we see things through a trauma lens and still consider so many people to be the enemy and the other and and that. So net zero trauma just means that we're no longer adding to the burden of trauma. Then we need net negative trauma to try to anchor that. So I do think that these changes take multiple generations. So the backlash against psychedelics started in the 60s. 1970 was the Controlled Substances Act. We're half a century past that. So I think another half of a century from now, the goal of introduction of psychedelics and more focus on mental health is really to change mass consciousness. And so that's the new vision, is net zero trauma by 2070. And that's what, again, requires the humanitarian projects, requires drug legalization and medicalization, and also the growth of psychedelic religions.
It's going to be wild.
It's good. Yeah.
It already is. It already is. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's like touch and go, though.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
It's like, who knows if
we're going to make it.
Yeah, and in fact, I'll say I've gotten to know and be friends with Darren Aronofsky, who's the movie director. And I was just in Las Vegas a while ago for the Sphere
The big new facility. Yeah. It's pretty wild.
And so they showed as part of the opening was this Postcards from Earth, which is just beautiful, beautiful movie that he made. Uh-huh. But the first part is this beautiful scenes from nature, just all over the world. Yeah. There's incredibly beautiful nature stuff you've never seen, but just fantastic. Then the second is all the destruction and all the pollution. Mm-hmm. But then this is what we want to change. The third part was where I was really a little bit upset by this. The third part is it turns into like a science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a bunch of people are like, we've so fucked it up in the earth. And we've put such a burden on this earth that we need to leave and give it a rest.
Get out of here.
And so then it's all these spaceships going up into space. And then they land on some planet.
Yeah.
It's a completely barren planet, but they have a magic seed that they put there, and then everything blooms again.
Yeah,
so this idea, of course, we carry the same consciousness that has fucked up things here to where we go.
You're right.
So instead of that, we need this idea of fixing things here, I think. So that's this also net zero trauma of 27 is we got to change what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And can we do that in time or not? Life on Earth will survive. You know, the dinosaurs aren't here anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe the humans won't be here anymore. Hopefully that won't happen. But to bring it back to psychedelics, they can play a major role in consciousness change and healing of trauma, especially when combined with therapy and support and wise use.
Yeah. I could talk to you for much longer, but I have the sense that you need to get going back to your daily routine. But MAPS, the nonprofit, is still a nonprofit, and I imagine that you're going to need donations. So do you want to make a pitch for...
Thank you. Yes. Yes, exactly. So we're also starting a membership campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We do need donations, particularly for the humanitarian project. So as the pharma company focuses on trying to get cash flow positive and trying to get approval in other jurisdictions, the nonprofit is going to be doing these various humanitarian projects. I just... You know, sort of mentioned to you before that I just come back from Dubai and Abu Dhabi. We're trying to bring MDMA assisted therapy to the Arab region as well. So MAPS could definitely use donations. We have some new incredible project that we just signed a contract with the Denver police. So what we're doing, and this Sherelle worked on this at the very beginning, is that Denver was the first city to make mushrooms a lowest enforcement priority.
Yeah.
So we're now educating first responders in what to do if they see somebody with a difficult psychedelic trip.
Oh, wow.
So that's one of the things that we're wanting to do, and we want to follow drug policy reform to do that in those places. And the other thing I'll say is that in 2025, in June, I think starting the 21st or so, we're going to have the next Psychedelic Science 2025 conference.
Oh, sweet. Where?
In Denver. The same place as before. We're hoping around 20,000 people. And in June of 2023, we had the world's largest conference on psychedelics. 12,400 people. Yeah. It was fantastic. And so... We sort of schedule these things when it's a new world.
Yeah.
And so 2025 will be the new world of prescription access, hopefully. And so I'd like to encourage people who are interested to mark it into your calendars. Yeah. So we're going to announce it in the next couple weeks with the actual dates and things like that. But I think that the philanthropy has powered this whole change. Yeah. And we're going to need philanthropy to power this change around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. And, well, I'll just add that public education, we're getting the data. So I think what's really necessary is this public education.
Yeah.
And another part of it is, in addition to podcasts and stuff, is that we need storylines in TV shows and movies about psychedelics.
Mm.
I took a class from the guy that helped introduce designated driver concept to America.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And he did it through getting... plot lines on TV shows and movies.
No shit, really?
Yeah, because you don't realize you're being educated. You're just like, oh, this character, and
that's a good idea.
They're a designated driver. Oh, what's a designated driver? You know, it's much better than, oh, you know, don't drive drunk.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's Nine Perfect Strangers. There's a bunch of different kind of storylines about psychedelics that are making it into movies and TV. So I think if anybody that's listening, Natalie Ginsberg, who works with us as our global impact officer, did move to LA in part to try to get storylines that way. So, you know, if anybody's involved in that, we would love to consult on how to educate the people when they don't realize they're being educated.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Rick.
Great.
Appreciate it.
Great.
Thanks for listening to the Trip Report. We hope you enjoyed it. You can sign up to receive our free newsletter and get the podcast sent directly to your inbox by going to thetripreport.com. This podcast is a production from Beckley Waves, a psychedelic venture studio. If you're interested in learning more about building companies in the psychedelic space, head over to beckleywaves.com to get in touch. If you like this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and share it with your friends. I'm Zach Hegney. The Trip Report is produced by Kula Production Company with coordination from Caitlin Jabari. See you next time.